Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, at the time of European contact in the 1500s, Tumukwa-speaking Mocama controlled much of northeast Florida.
So on a day-to-day basis, most Mocamas lived in a community run largely by women, so households were run by women, who in turn made up the town, who was governed by either a male or female chief, or Olata.
We'll discuss women in British colonial Florida.
Most were born in Great Britain, possessed some level of basic literacy, and maintained regular correspondence with distant family members.
And we'll talk about the book Crafting Constitutions in Florida, 1810 to 1968. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. Fort Caroline was established in 1564 as a French Huguenot settlement on the St. John's River near Jacksonville. When the French arrived in Florida to create a European settlement, indigenous people had been living here for 10,000 years. Denise Bosset is professor of history at the University of North Florida.
Part of the reason the French select this area is because of the Mocamas. And the Mocama are a nation of Tumukwa speakers, whose ancestors and predecessors had made this region into their homelands for thousands of years before the French arrived. They were a highly complex, interconnected nation, themselves comprised of towns, probably 10 to 20 towns, under the leadership of paramount chiefs, as we call them, or Olatakare in Tumukwa, who helped to kind of bring together this coalition of towns, especially for foreign relations.
I think when we think about northeastern Florida's history, we tend to think about the Tumukwa, but northeast Florida has an incredibly rich indigenous history. I think one that's kind of underappreciated and underpublicized.
Keith Ashley is professor of anthropology at the University of North Florida.
If we think about it, most people, their image of the indigenous people of our area is like a five-year window into the lives of the Tumukwa in the 1560s, when in reality, indigenous people were here 10,000 or more years prior to that time and continued 150 years after that in northeast Florida and still continue to that today. So I think that one thing about this is that we really have this incredible history that we're trying to establish and to really for people to know about. So when we look at the 1560s, we really want to start looking at the history that led to that point in time and not just to focus on that little window. So we've done a lot of archaeology in this area to kind of really reveal that incredible history.
So on a day-to-day basis, most Mocamas lived in a community run largely by women. So households were run by women who in turn made up the town, who was governed by either a male or female chief or Olata. There are, in fact, many women who ran towns at a political level among the Mocama. And these communities across sort of the region from north of St. Augustine to south of the Altamaha River were really woven together largely by women who created kinship ties across these communities. So they would come together for foreign relations, but on a day-to-day basis, really govern themselves as households and towns.
So really there's no people that are Tumukwa. It's a language that's a Tumukwa language. And then there are a series of dialects throughout the Tumukwa lands that are Mocama is one on Potanos near Gainesville. So really it's just a dialect of a much broader language. And sometimes we'll say Mocama just to provide a little more specificity that we're talking about the ones that are along the coast. Mocama actually means the sea.
They lived especially along the water. They're water people. The word Mocama means the sea. So they're people of the sea, but they were also the people of the marshes. And they had long had contact with outsiders as far as present-day St. Louis, where Cahokia was in the 11th century. We know there was direct contact with our region too. So Long had been part of this very dynamic, diverse, indigenous world that involved religious exchange, political exchange. On the eve of the French arrival, the Mocama are interwoven into sort of a political landscape that includes both alliances within their nation and then also enemies outside of their nation. And it's into this sort of political environment that the French arrive, and this is why the Mocamas have any interest in allying with outsiders, is to help them foster their nation, protect their nation, take care of their homeland.
We know that the Mocama, this is their homeland. We know that it basically stretched from probably just south of the St. John's River, probably to about the Satila River in southeastern Georgia. We know that there was a series of towns that were there. We know the names of some of them, but both the Spanish and the French accounts. Some of them, the Spanish accounts, are a little different than the French accounts. So we understand that there's this network of these towns that are kind of organized. They're in alliances. They're interacting sometimes as friends and sometimes as enemies with other Tumukwas that are further, you know, up or south along the St. John's River. So we can kind of see their kind of relationships playing out in different ways, and the Spanish and French kind of become involved in that situation.
So the French first come in May of 1562, briefly interact over the course of 2 days with Mocama leaders, especially one of the main leaders named Satariwa, who took his name from his town, as was very common with sort of these higher level leaders. He was not only a political leader, but a military leader. The French come briefly. They also explore up to present-day South Carolina. They briefly establish a settlement at Paris Island. And then when they come back in 1564, it's expressly to come back here because they have had an okay encounter, complicated, but okay encounter with Satariwa. And they also believe this area is really rich in local resources and will be a great place to establish what is really a military outpost, then hoping to later on establish a colony. So they're coming intentionally to this area, and in large part because of the indigenous people who are already here, who seem to them to be quite wealthy. They notice a lot of gold and silver that Mocamas are wearing. Who also have a lot of food resources, so they hope that they can exploit that too. So that's why they're here, is because of the Mocama.
St. Augustine is the oldest continuously occupied city in what is now the United States. The city was founded in 1565 by the Roman Catholic Spanish. If the Spanish had not sent Don Pedro Menendez de Avilés to Florida to eradicate the Protestant French people at Fort Caroline, St. Augustine may have never been built. Despite this European conflict in Florida, Denise Bosse points out that the region was controlled by the Tumukwa-speaking Mocama.
So Tumukwa is the name of a language, not a people. We know that right before contact, there were probably 10 or 11 dialects of Tumukwa spoken. Mocama was one of those. And the total population of Tumukwas was probably about 200,000 people, stretched really across the center of the current state of Florida, from the east even to the west coast. And they were organized into a lot of different nations. So the Mocama were one nation among many who spoke Tumukwa. And we call the Mocama, Mocama. We don't know what they called themselves. So we call them by the name of their dialect to make it a little bit easier. Most Mocamas and most Tumukwas probably mostly identified as members of their families or clans, which were run by women, and then members of towns, who were then grouped into these associations of nations, kind of like our states, you know, the relationship between states and federal government.
Basically, we've established a couple of important things. We know what pottery they were making. We clearly understand as archaeologists that pots are not people, but at least it gives us a good marker. So if we find a lot of pottery that we know dates to this period, we can say that there's a larger settlement here. So I think 20, 25 years ago, we may have said it was another pottery type. Now we're clearly convinced of what it is, so we can establish where we find large amounts of that pottery, that that's a community. And so now we're trying to correlate these areas that we find archaeologically with possibly known sites that are in the documents, known towns in the documents. And we feel pretty confident about some of them. We're not forcing our names on those. We've recently been working on Big Talbot Island here in the Jacksonville area, and we're fairly convinced we have the Mocama town of Sarah Bay. And in fact, we've even found a large structure out there that's more than 70 feet in diameter that we think might be their council house. So it's really nice to really, and date, radiocarbon dates. We have some European artifacts that really are going to say that this site is probably 1580s, 1620 range.
We also know about them through Spanish and French records. And it's interesting because until recently, most historians who read records by the French and Spanish largely ignored all of the content about the Mocama. When you read the French themselves, their primary concern is indigenous people. They're very worried about the Spanish because they've invaded what the Spanish claim to be their territory. But once they get on the ground, they quickly realize that all of this space is owned by indigenous people. So they themselves talk a lot about the rituals, the ceremonies, the protocols of diplomacy especially. They talk about religion, they talk about how the Mocamas are organized, what they're eating, and do a lot of what we would think of as sort of early anthropological observations.
Denise Bosse is professor of history and Keith Ashley is professor of anthropology at the University of North Florida. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Registration is now open for the Florida Historical Society Public History Forum, May 28th through 30th at the Shores Resort and Spa in Daytona Beach. The event features engaging panel discussions, tours of historic sites and museums, and much more. Information is at myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, one of the least studied periods of Florida history is the British colonial era that lasted from 1763 to 1783. Deborah Bauer focused on a topic that is even less studied, the role of women in that era.
Deborah Bauer, at the time a Ph.D. student at the University of South Florida, published an article in the 2010 issue of the Florida Historical Quarterly on the role of British women in the colonization of East and West Florida. The pertinent historiography is limited and centers on two opposing interpretations, a romanticized or glamorized perspective that British women living in Florida were charming ladies, well-traveled, gowned in silk and jewels, who spent their time attending balls and social assemblies. Their contribution to the establishment of the social order was limited. A second historiographic interpretation contends that, as was typical for almost any frontier community, women were scarce in British Florida and implies that no further study is necessary. Bauer challenges both views. Studying the experiences of British women who immigrated to East and West Florida during the period 1760 to the 1770s will provide a foundation for understanding the social-cultural development of British-controlled region. The British capture of Havana in 1762 ensured that the Spanish allies of the French would make substantial concessions in the subsequent negotiations that resulted in the Treaty of Paris that ended the French and Indian War. Acquiring Spanish Florida, the British set out to integrate East and West Florida with the southern colonies that ranged from Virginia to Georgia. As the historian Kathleen Wilson argued, British women offered civility, refinement, and sensibility on behalf of the common good, as governmental and military officials sought to make East and West Florida the latest success story for the expansion of British imperial power and prestige.
What sort of challenges did women face in Florida?
Bauer offers a general description of the women who immigrated to the colonies. Most were born in Great Britain, possessed some level of basic literacy, and maintained regular correspondence with distant family members. They read the Bible and literary works and had basic knowledge of arithmetic. Many had training in the feminine arts of music, dancing, sewing, cooking, and housekeeping. Most were members of the Church of England and came from economically prosperous families. A number of them shared kinship with prominent families in Boston, Charleston, New York, and Philadelphia. The number of men and women who arrived in St. Augustine in the 1760s did not number more than a few hundred in the years of British control. Numbers alone did not define the role of British women. Their arrival in 1763 established an immigration pattern that would continue for the next 20 years. The women who immigrated to Florida were the wives, daughters, mothers, or sisters of government officials or members of the military. They entered a new physical and social environment. When Dorothy Forbes arrived in St. Augustine as a newlywed, she confessed to her family that although she was in a strange place, they should not worry about her. Fortunately for her, other women assisted in her acclimation to the surroundings and to her status in the colony. As wives of government officials and military officers, women like Forbes could claim elite status and associated with the most powerful members of the colonial society. Women faced many of the same dangers as men. Traveling by land entailed possible violent encounters with indigenous people, and most women traveled by ship. Storms represented ocean hazards, but so did mutiny and pirates. Rebecca Walker Dunford, the wife of the Lieutenant Governor of West Florida, was aboard a ship bound for England when the crew began drinking during a storm and mutinied. Some of the crew entered her cabin, and she was thrown out of the berth with the bedclothes twisted around her and onto a black trunk. She was rescued by a ship bound for Nova Scotia, but as Bauer notes, not all colonial women were as lucky in the same situation. Shipwrecks were reported with some regularity. Tropical storms and hurricanes battered the Florida coasts then as now. Elizabeth Digby Pilot reported on a 1769 storm that left her terrified by, quote, the violent tempest attended by heavy rain. As she described the scene, the whole camp was in an uproar. The soldiers' huts were mostly blown down. The women and children were running about screaming with consternation. Then men were all in confusion, and a scene of sad devastation presented itself. Disease and other medical issues affected the health and shortened the lives of women who immigrated to Florida. The heat and humidity were especially difficult for women who were expected to dress modestly. Beset by swarms of insects, they were susceptible to malaria, yellow fever, cholera, dysentery, and smallpox. Of the six women who accompanied Elizabeth Pilot from Havana to Pensacola in July 1765, all six died during an outbreak of malignant fever, possibly yellow fever, which ravaged Pensacola between late 1765 and early 1766. Pilot reported that coffins were so scarce that a single coffin was used repeatedly to transport bodies for burial. Death was so familiar, she wrote, that we met our friends with sad countenances, expecting to hear some new victim. While men and women faced the same likelihood of death by disease, women faced the demands of childbirth frequently and without access to the level of medical care they might receive in England or in more settled colonies. The pregnancy history of Dorothy Forbes provides insight into the complexity of marriage, family, and childbirth. In 1772, Forbes was pregnant with her third child. Weakened by three closely timed pregnancies, she was concerned for her own health. Her mother had died in childbirth, and wrote to her father about her worries. He arranged for her to travel to Milton, Massachusetts, where medical care would be better. By the time he arrived to escort his daughter and grandchildren north, Dorothy was 7 months pregnant. Her husband refused to allow the children to travel, but finally compromised and kept the oldest son with him. She arrived safely and gave birth to a third son, but she never saw her husband again.
Connie, were the lives of British colonial women in Florida always so grim?
Women occupied their time in Florida in some productive and entertaining ways. In 1770, the West Florida Assembly enacted legislation that provided married women limited freedom regarding property. Rebecca Dunford took advantage of the opportunity and acquired several large tracts of land in her name. However, in extending the privilege of landholding, the Assembly was recognizing the danger of life in Florida and the potential need for women to be able to provide for themselves. British settlers established an active social life. In the evenings, singing, dancing, card playing, and gossiping occurred in the various homes of the colonists. Governor James Grant was known for his frequent dinner parties and evenings of entertainment.
By the mid-1770s, the end was in sight for British Florida. How did the colony change as the American Revolution progressed?
The most obvious change could be seen in the migration patterns. As a non-participant in the Revolution, Florida served as a safe haven for loyalists escaping from the war. Elizabeth Lichtenstein Johnston, the wife of a loyalist Georgia physician, arrived in the fall of 1782 with a flood of other refugees. The population of East Florida swelled from approximately 3,000 to over 20,000 during the final years of the Revolution. The final British ship left St. Augustine in June 1785, completing an 18-month evacuation, with most colonists sailing to Nova Scotia, the Bahamas, or Great Britain. Among the many evacuees were British women whose lives and contributions to the colony had been largely overlooked. As Deborah Bauer argued, it is time to write them into the narrative.
Indeed. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Florida has created half a dozen different constitutions over the past two centuries. As Sebastian Garcia reports, a new book looks at all of them.
Dr. Robert Casanello is an associate professor of history at the University of Central Florida. Dr. Casanello edited a recently published book titled Crafting Constitutions in Florida, 1810 to 1968. The book examines the conditions that created each state constitution throughout Florida's history, including the West and East Florida, as well as the indigenous constitutions.
Florida is one of those states that has multiple constitutions. And so if we're talking about just the state constitutions, you know, there's an antebellum constitution, there's a constitution during the Civil War, there are two Reconstruction constitutions, there's a Jim Crow constitution, and there's a 1968, if you want to refer to it as a modern constitution. And so each of these constitutions exists because Florida was sort of at a crossroads, if you will, at each of those points in time. One of the things I wanted to do with this collection was treat the constitutions like a text. And so to each author, I went to them and I said, look, your constitution exists at a point in time for a reason. You need to kind of explain that reason. So it's like whatever year your constitution is drafted and ratified, you know, represents something going in Florida that kind of influenced that desire to create a new constitution. So that was the ways in which I thought, okay, this would be a good idea to kind of understand these constitutions and create continuity between each constitution if we're talking about why they're created, what was going on around at the time. And also, I thought it'd be like the most manageable thing to just look at the constitutional conventions and the drafting of each of these constitutions and kind of end at the ratification and not go into the life of the Constitution, because it would be like a whole nother thing. And then it wouldn't kind of represent that moment in time anymore, because then it would be, you know, decades later, politicians or maybe even voters would recognize, oh, well, this, you know, issue here isn't working the way we thought, so let's amend this. And then that amendment would have to thus be contextualized. So just crafting the constitutions, writing the constitution, was really just the focus of this book.
For example, the 1838 Territorial Constitution simultaneously reflected the enthusiasm for statehood and anxieties about the bank crises of the 1830s and 1840s with its provisions to regulate banking.
If we take the 1838 Constitution, which is the territorial constitution, that was the constitution that was designed specifically to get Florida accepted as a state to the United States. So it was actually crafted when Florida was still a territory, but it was looking forward to the point that Florida would be a state. So the constitution was drafted in such a way that it could be adapted into a state constitution. And so sort of what it represents is that period in time, and the lawmakers at that time were really kind of interested in controlling kind of the economic fortunes of Florida. What makes the 1838 Constitution different from other state constitutions is that it specifically regulated banking, and it's the only state constitution that interferes or regulates, however you want to describe it, into banking in a state. And that was because of sort of these banking controversies that were taking place in Florida in the 1830s and into the 1840s.
Although present in each of the state constitutions, how delegates drafted the idea of suffrage into the documents differed depending on the social, political, and historical context of the time.
One of the most interesting issues that appear in the state constitutions is that of suffrage. I mean, this is something that's in every constitution because what the constitution has to define is the right of people to vote and the eligibility of them to vote. And so this is something that each of the constitutional conventions, even going back to the 1810 West Florida revolt on through the 1968 state constitution, delegates had to kind of grapple with that. So it's interesting to track suffrage from the early constitutions to the modern constitutions because it changes quite a bit over time. And I think Floridians would be surprised to learn how and why it changes. And again, it changes because the conditions in Florida and the context for them change. So, you know, with the rebellion constitutions, the 1810 West Florida and the 1812 East Florida constitutions, those were constitutions that were coming out of the revolutionary era, right? But they weren't quite revolutionary documents because the qualifications for suffrage were actually more liberal than the U.S. Constitution at the time. Those constitutions had no property requirements for voting. They had property requirements for serving in office, but no property requirements for voting, which was kind of an indication of what would come with Jacksonian democracy, this idea of direct democracy and eligible voters, and at the time would be white males over the age of 21, all being eligible to vote. And of course, we see that in the antebellum constitution. And then, you know, later on, after the Civil War, you see suffrage being written so that African-American men could vote in the 1860s. You know, that transitions into 1885, with African-American men still being able to vote in 1885. However, in the Constitution, there are restrictions to voting, which allowed for a poll tax, and eventually, if the state of Florida decided, a literacy test, right? And even in the indigenous constitutions, there had to be references to who was eligible to vote in the body politic of the Seminoles and Miccosukees. And it wasn't just, you know, if you were born on the reservation. But actually it was about parenthood and whether your ancestors existed on certain census rolls and things like that.
To learn more about Florida's constitutional history, consider reading Crafting Constitutions in Florida, 1810 to 1968, edited by Dr. Robert Castanello and published by the University Press of Florida. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS Media Production Assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida, Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week and find us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.